Hey, how's it going, everybody? Welcome to the Elemental Evan podcast. This is your host, Evan Roberts. And on this podcast, I break down health topics from a holistic and simplified perspective. However, on today's episode, we are going to shift slightly because we are joined by a truly astounding guest, Dr. Amani Ballour. Now, there is a ton to say about Dr. Amani, but honestly, I'm just going to let the episode do the talking and give you a quick idea of who Dr. Amani is. So for starters, she's a pediatrician, an activist, as well as an author. But more importantly, she was the very first woman to hold the position of hospital director in Syria. And more importantly, it wasn't just any old hospital, but rather it was the hospital referred to as the Cave. Now, it's referred to as the Cave because it is literally underground. They had to do this because it was just too dangerous to have a hospital above ground due to a lot of the bombings that were taking place during the time that she was in Syria. Now, Dr. Amani has both a documentary that is on Hulu, and it was produced by National Geographic, titled The Cave. If you haven't already gone and watched the documentary, I highly recommend that you do. It is a great way to get a brief insight into what was going on at the time and covers a bit more about what the cave was and all of the events that kind of took place there. If you want a deeper look into Dr. Amani's story as well as the cave, which I highly recommend, then you can also read her book, The Cave, A Secret Underground Hospital and One Woman's Story of Survival in Syria. This book goes much, much deeper into all of the fine details of the events that took place while Dr. Amani was out there. It is pretty heart-wrenching, I'm not gonna lie. There's some really difficult parts to read in there, but it is so important for us to stay up to date and educated on these events that are occurring globally. So for this episode, I wanted to touch on a few quick points that were things that kind of arose for me during both the actual filming of this podcast episode, but also in the research I was doing leading up to the episode. And that was, first off, if you haven't practiced gratitude today, then please go ahead and do so, because I promise you, life can be so much worse and so much more difficult than it already is. So please, if you haven't already, please take a moment to find some gratitude, even for the small things in life. Maybe it's just a little bit of food on the table. Maybe it's the roof over your head, your friends, your family, your loved ones. Maybe it's just being able to go outside and enjoy some sunshine. It can be very simple things, but please practice some gratitude today, because I promise you there are so many things in our lives that we can be grateful for. Number two is going to be to educate ourselves and to extend a hand out to our neighbors, right? And I mean literally our neighbors next door as well as our neighbors globally, right? Because we are a very connected world, being that we have the ability to communicate with each other so easily. And, you know, we can see all the different events that are going on. And it really is just a great practice for us to extend a hand out to our neighbors and, you know, really offer, even if it's just time or help, doing very little things. Maybe it's even just being nice to our neighbors, right? Showing a smile, making them feel welcomed. It's the little things that we can do to really help each other out and make this world a bit more peaceful and enjoyable. Remember, Gandhi did say, be the change that you wish to see. And it is so true, because at the end of the day, the only thing that we can control is ourselves and our actions. So please, if you haven't already, show some compassion for others around you. And if you can help out others across the globe, either with your time or your money or whatever it may be, then please go ahead and do so as well. And last but not least, if you know a medical professional, please show them some love as well, because it is a very difficult job. And, you know, medical professionals truly do the best that they can. And, you know, they work super hard and long hours, and they're doing really some amazing work to try to keep us all healthy and safe. So please, if you know a medical professional, go ahead, shoot them a text message, give them a call, give them a hug, and just let them know that you appreciate all of the work that they're doing. And without further ado, let's just go ahead and jump into today's episode, which is once again going to be a little bit different than the normal episodes that we have on here, but nonetheless, it's going to be a really impactful one. So I hope you all enjoy and have some major takeaways from today's episode. Let's go ahead and get into it. Let's welcome Dr. Amani. Hi, Dr. Amani. Thank you very much for joining me on today's episode. How are you doing today?
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Awesome, Dr. Amani. Well, hey, I like to usually just dive right into the episode. And I think for today's episode, it would probably be a good idea to provide the listeners with a little bit of a background on both the situation in Syria as well as your role as the first woman to be the hospital director of a hospital known as The Cave in Syria. If you wouldn't mind providing a little bit of background just to catch everybody up to speed on that, that would be amazing.
Well, yeah, the Syrian revolution started in 2011. It started like a peaceful protest in the street, like many Syrian people start this demanding human rights, demanding democracy and dignity. In Syria, I think people don't know, we have a dictator, and he's now the president for 24 years, and his father was before him for like 30 years. So, you know, we have no elections, no democracy. And the people are really oppressed, and we can't talk a word about freedom, about human rights. So, yeah, the just Syrian people wanted to ask about their rights. That's why it started in 2011. I was studying medicine. I was in my fifth year at the medical school. And immediately after the protest started, the dictator, the president, Bashar al-Assad, and his regime started to shoot people, to kill them. And then they started to bomb, targeted the cities everywhere, the cities which has protest, and to bomb, to kill everyone, to destroy everything. The Syrian regime with its allies, Russia and Iran. So yeah, they started to do this using all the types of weapons. I was just a medical student and I wanted to do something to help my people. I saw the innocent people were being killed, the children, the women. So I decided that I graduated in 2012 from the medical school. I was dreaming to study pediatrics, and just I started studying pediatrics for 1 month, 2 months, then you know, the bombing and everything start to be in my city, in my town. So I decided just to stay there to help the people there. Then the Syrian regime besieged us, besieged the cities and the towns. So we were like 500,000 people in a place in countryside of Damascus. They besieged us and they prevent at the beginning food and medicine. And then they prevent everything. No one can go in or out. And that lasted for more than 6 years. Of course, we didn't expect this, but it was very hard time.
Yeah, it's definitely a difficult reality for sure. And, you know, watching a lot of it on the documentary of yours, The Cave on Hulu, was it's a hard thing to watch, let alone to obviously live through. So, yeah, I know there's a lot to unpack there for sure. But one thing I wanted to start off with was, did you want to be the hospital director, or was that something that was just kind of thrown upon you by everybody else?
Well, let me first tell you about The Cave. The Syrian regime started to target hospitals from the beginning. So they destroyed many hospitals near us. That's why we moved to work underground in the basements, you know, anywhere, hidden places or somewhere. So we moved underground. We found a basement. It was just two rooms at the beginning. Then we expanded, you know, year after year. We make it a big hospital underground. And we also made tunnels to connect the hospital with other places from underground because it was hard to move on the ground because of the heavy bombing. I started working in this hospital since, you know, it started in 2012. I know the hospital. I know what we need. I know, I know maybe I have plans and, you know, opinion about how we can develop it, what exactly we need. And, you know, I was a doctor like other doctors who started to manage this hospital. So I believe that I can do something to improve this hospital, develop it, make everything better. You know, I have plans and I believe that it's fine. I mean, there's nothing can, you know, prevent me of being the manager of this hospital. So there were like, we made like their elections, but small elections. We were like 12 or 13 doctors and we choose the manager between us. So one of the doctors said that I believe that you can do it, Amani. So why you don't nominate yourself? And I said, yeah, I can. I think I can do it. And I did. And yeah, my colleagues chose me to be the manager for at the beginning 6 months. Then they wanted me to stay for more 6 months and then for a year. So I stayed there like a manager for 2 years before we forced to leave the area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And on that note, what kind of difficulties were you experiencing during that time as the director of the hospital, especially being, you know, a woman in a traditionally man's role? Like confrontations from people did you receive, or just difficulties in general did you experience?
Well, everything was, you know, difficult. Everything was a challenge. Starting from being a manager of a hospital in a war zone, besieged area, there's no resources, no enough food, no medicine, no medical supplies. Everything was prevented. We have like these tunnels to connect us with Damascus city. So we tried many times, you know, to smuggle some food, some medicine, some medical devices sometimes, but still, you know, lack of everything, lack of for example, diagnosis tools. So patients and everyone were suffering to have the resources at the beginning. Second, I can talk about the protecting the hospital and the health workers, because we were a target for the bombing for the Syrian regime and Russia. And although we were underground, but it wasn't safe. I mean, and in 2015, they targeted our hospital. It was underground and they targeted us. The missile were underground and explode in it. I mean, I was sitting with my colleagues, three of them, and when the missile said, I just went to the emergency room, and then the bomb happened, and it killed three of my colleagues. So, and it destroyed part of the hospital, so it wasn't safe working underground. This was also a challenge to protect this hospital, to protect, you know, the ambulance, protect everyone. Also, that was a challenge. And beside all these challenges, I mean, I was a woman, so many of my community men criticized me just because I was a woman. I was just starting to manage the hospital, and they started, you know, to say, like, don't we have enough men to bring this woman to be a manager? They remember the young man. He was educated. He was my colleague and my friends before I started to be a manager. And he said, we have no problem with you. You are our colleague, but we don't want a woman to be our manager. So, you know, that was really frustrating for me to hear this from a colleague of mine, from a young man, from educated man. So that was really, you know, I mean, it's bad to hear this, but it was like it pushed me to approve that we can do something. I have to do something in this position, because if I failed, they will say this about all the women in the area. I was the first woman to manage like a hospital in a war zone in these circumstances. So I decided that I have to succeed. And I tried, you know, do my best to make this hospital continue. It was the central hospital in the area. And yeah, thank God it was good. It stayed for last time before we left. After many hospitals, underground hospitals, were destroyed by bombing, and our hospital stayed, and we had good, medical supply and medicine. It wasn't enough, of course, but it was good, you know, to help many people. And it was protected because we make these tunnels. We had this plan to protect it. We have, you know, the available resources. We put like many bags of sand on the hospital, on the place above the hospital to protect it. And that was, you know, I can say partially it was good. So yeah, we stayed. We worked to the last minute. And after this, I remember like many of the men who criticized me, many of them came to me and they said, you were good, you did a great job. I was very happy to do this. I can say it like it was a winning for many women, not only for me. So that was a very happy moment to hear this from them.
Yeah, yeah. And I applaud you for sure, because it's not an easy task for anyone to do. And I believe, you know, from at least from what I've seen and from, you know, reading your book, like you definitely put your heart and soul into it. And that's all anyone can ask for. So yeah, you definitely did the best that you absolutely could with what you had. And on that note as well, the reason you were evacuated out from the hospital was it because the Russians had said that they were gonna like bomb specifically this the cave? Was that the reason for leaving?
They really started bombing the whole area where, as I said, like 500,000 people in the area with also many hospitals. They started this like military campaign. It was very, very heavy bombing every second, every minute. They tried to bomb the hospital many times. The missiles were, you know, falling around us and next to us many times. And they started, you know, to come close and close to our hospital. So, you know, everyone, when they get closer to them, just flee. And all these people and all, you know, in the area we went, we stayed only in like two small towns. Everyone, all the people who were fleeing, you know, from the Syrian regime and from the Russian, it was like, I can say it was a Russian campaign. Actually, Russian military campaign. And the leader who made the negotiation with the people, he was a Russian leader. So he said, as I heard from my colleague, one of my colleagues were in this negotiation, and he said, you can leave, we allow you to leave, or we kill all of you. And you know, really, they killed many people at this campaign. It lasted for 1.5 months, and they killed many, many people. And I remember, just a day before we leave the hospital, there were a big massacre when they told the people in the area that there's some food or someone selling food on the main street in my town. And people were sitting underground hiding without food for a few days. So many people go there. They believe this and they think that they will get food, you know, for their children and their families. And the war plan targeted them and killed many, many people. I remember many people. They were just on the ground in the hospital, on the corridors, bleeding, and we were just watching. I mean, we can help one, two, but not, you know, they were nearly maybe 100, 200, like, I can't remember. But yeah, that was horrible. You know, we wanted to stay in our country. We don't want to leave. I mean, no one liked to leave their countries. But we, you know, after all this, we had to leave. So they brought a passes for us and they sent us to the north of Syria. This area is out of the Syrian regime control.
And you mentioned the, you know, this massacre that took place, not to mention the countless other bombings, as well as the use of chemical warfare. You know, how do you even assess all of these people when they start flooding into the hospital? Like what's the first process that you're going through when, especially with the chemical warfare, where you don't even know what's wrong with these people that are coming in? Like what are the first steps that you take to try to assess the situation and to get a hold on things?
Well, the first chemical attack I witnessed, it was in 2013, and we were just, you know, started the hospital. It was a small hospital at the beginning. We were some doctors, like few doctors, some volunteers, and many of the medical staff were volunteers. Actually, many, many doctors left the area before the siege. When the bombing started, they start to flee. So yeah, we were few doctors. I mean, I was just graduated. I graduated in 2012. I had no experience. And, you know, I remember that night when I was sleeping during the night. It's nearly 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. when I started not to hear this noise, and I went to the hospital after when I started my book writing about this, because it was the worst thing I ever, you know, witnessed. And yeah, I went to the hospital to see like many, many people on the ground inside the hospital and on the ground out of the hospital, like many people. And many of them were just dead, and others were moving. They just, you know, they don't, I mean, don't speak, don't cry, just suffocating and moving. Many, many children among these people. And, you know, when people suffocating, it's emergency case. So all of them were emergencies. They need very, you know, fast help. And we were just few doctors. I remember just trying to pass between these people to go inside the hospital to know what to do. And I remember to see my colleague, other internal doctor, and I asked her, what do you do for these people? I mean, how you do? And she said, just we give them atropine. And, you know, we didn't know what happened for them. We didn't know it was like chemical. We said like maybe they inhale chemical, but what kind of chemical, you know, material, we didn't know. So we knew later it was sarin, but yeah, it was like a shock for us. And I started just to do what I can do. I just sit between these people in somewhere. I just to sit there and start to give atropine to, you know, to just suck the, you know, the foam from their mouths and nose. It was, you know, horrible. We had no plan to deal with this. I have no training to deal with this. Other doctors also, the doctors who are specialists older than me, they don't know what is this. I mean, what kind of chemicals is this? How we should to deal with it? But we just started to work, you know, as a doctor to, you know, to save the lives. I mean, it was horrible. Many people died that night. Like, they said, like, the numbers, it's of course not accurate number. They said 1,500 people died, and many of them were children. I remember, you know, working with the children that night. They were suffocating in front of me. If I help a child, the other child immediately died, you know. I have only, like, a few minutes to help someone who's suffocating. So it was very, very hard. And I still, you know, feel guilty because I didn't help everyone. I mean, yeah, I said, why I chose this child, not the other child? I mean, yeah, it's hard to remember also. That's why writing this book was very, very hard choice. And I think a lot before, I mean, I said, do I have to tell this story, remember everything with the details, all the massacres which would happen before this chemical attack and after this, many attacks happened. They used the chemical weapons again and again. So yeah, it was hard, you know, choice to me that I want to tell this story, but I felt that it's a responsibility to tell about the victims' story, tell about them. They were innocent. They deserve better life. These children, they have dreams. They were hungry. They were afraid. And they just, you know, died in this way. So I think that they deserve to tell their stories.
Yeah. And the chemical, sorry, I kind of missed the chemical you mentioned that was used, but it specifically targets the lungs and causes suffocation. Is that typically what that chemical does?
Yeah, it's sarin gas. People inhale it and it's suffocating them, and it targets also the nerves. So it makes, you know, people like paralyzed. So they were just on the ground with, you know, cold bodies, dark clips, and with the foam. So we didn't know what is this. Some of them were like moving. I'm not sure, like it was like seizures or something, but they were just moving like this and they were unconscious. So that was very hard to deal with it.
And when you were in that situation, what kind of mindset did you have to get yourself into to not just freeze in shock of what's going on, but rather to take action and make sure that you're doing whatever that you possibly can? Like, how do you, what kind of a mindset did you have to get yourself into? Because I know so many people in a situation, you know, not even nearly half as bad as that, they tend to freeze up. How did you get yourself to jump to action and move and do things?
Exactly. It was like very hard. When I see everyone on the ground, like I thought I was sleeping because I just, you know, woke up and went to the hospital. Is it a dream or nightmare or something? And then I look for everyone. I mean, it's real. It happened. And I see one of my colleagues also just was standing and choking and couldn't work and do anything. I looked at the children next to me and I see this child. I remember it's twins, two girls next to each other. They were suffocating and I looked exactly to them. I tried to focus on them and I said, they need help. You know, I have a job to do. And they sit next to them, started to working, helping them. And I started just to focus on my job, not to think about anything else. I mean, it's very hard, but it's possible. And I started working with these kids. And then, you know, to the another kids next to me and other kids. And some people bring kids to me because they know that I was studying pediatrics. So they said, this is a pediatrician, she can help. I tried, you know, just to focus, you know, in just a small area next to me and to try to help everyone. I didn't cry, and I just focused very much on what I have to do, what we have, like what the medicine that we have. We had not enough oxygen, and that was very hard to deal with. That's why many people died that night. So yeah, I just tried to be focusing, and in this way, like the whole night, you know, passed, and I remember like, I just when I really woke up and start to think about this, maybe after 3 days. But now I can think more and more about this. I can blame myself because I didn't help everyone. Think about, you know, these feelings. It's, you know, very hard. And I'm really happy because I didn't think about this when I was there. So I could, you know, help or do something to help people.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, definitely, I mean, easier said than done, but of course you can't blame yourself. You did the absolute best that you could, you know, and it's easy to look back and be critical on ourselves, but of course you did absolutely the best that you could with what you had. In terms of the aftermath of these events, did you have a process where when you finally were able to go home from the hospital, you know, did you have a process where you would try to de-stress or stop thinking of the events of the day? Like, was there any practices that you were using to try to just kind of, yeah, decompress and unload and not internalize all of the events of the day?
There were no time to do anything for yourself there, you know. After this massacre, it was at night, and in the morning, the Syrian regime targeted a hospital next to us. They bombed it and they killed some people and they affected the hospital. So they brought the casualties to our hospital. I remember like 3 or 4 people, they were, you know, bleeding and have injuries. So we have, you know, we just were day after night. I mean, I didn't remember just because we were underground. So many, many times we don't know it's a day or a night, you know. It was, you know, hard to think about ourselves, or it's hard to think about other people's feelings. And this is also something sometimes I blame myself about it. I remember that woman who asked me, in the midst of this massacre, the chemical massacre, she asked me to go with her to see her children. And she said she had 3 children and they were, you know, they died in this chemical attack. So she wants some support from me or something, and she said they died, come to see them, because she know that I knew her children. I couldn't go with her. I have job to do, so there's something, yeah, I mean, more important to do to save the other lives, people who still alive. So yeah, I also blame myself how I didn't care about her feelings. A mother just lost her 3 children. Can you imagine this? So yeah, of course I didn't think about myself, and I didn't have time. I was just working, and I don't remember, I don't go a lot to my home. I mean, I spent most of my time in the hospital. We have massacres. Sometimes we have 3 or 4 massacres a day. I mean, many casualties, working all the time. And just when I go home, I just sleep. And in the very early morning, I have to go to the hospital. But sometimes they bump during the night, so we had to book the hospital. Every time I hear sound, I go to the hospital. Or I hear the war blend sound very loud, I go to the hospital. So this is, was our life. And we didn't expect it will last, you know, for year after year after year, for 6 years, with no action from the international community, no action from, you know, the countries which talk all the time about the human rights, about the children's rights, women's rights. I mean, there were children that were dying without food, without enough food, without, with fear, I mean, with the bombing. So yeah, that lasted for like till 2018.
Wow. Yeah, and so I mean, obviously, you're on high alert the entire time you're out there. Now being, you know, no longer at the hospital, you know, how has the process of kind of processing these events been for you? Has it, you know, have you seeked out any type of help or anything to try and process these events or anything? How has that whole process been for you? In terms of going through everything that you've been through?
Well, I had a very hard time after we left, and I just stayed at home. And we were in northwest of Syria, and also there were bombing there. It's out of the Syrian regime control. So I couldn't work there. I went to a hospital there and tried to start working, but I couldn't. I was just, you know, have these memories, and I was shocked with everything happened. I start to think about everything. So it was very hard time. And then I moved to Turkey and I got married. I stayed at home for a few months there, thinking about everything and crying. And, you know, then I believe that, you know, the only way to go through this, to pass this, is to keep working, because people still need help and people still suffering. Many, many children who were there with me, they just... were displaced to the northwest of Syria, and they lived in camps, in camps, I mean, with very bad situation, you know, living in a tent, especially like in winter with the snow, with the, you know, the wind sometimes take the tent away. They were hungry. They have very, you know, millions of people in camps. So you can imagine. There's not enough food and not enough, you know, no access for healthcare services. So I joined the organization which was supporting the Kyiv Hospital, SAMHS, the Syrian American Medical Society, and I'm working now for them. And they, you know, I believe they're doing a great job supporting everyone with other organizations. The help, that not enough, of course, not enough, but it helps. I mean, we have like medical facilities, we're supporting them. We have a program for medical education, for example, training midwives and the nurses. This is also great, supporting women. They're supporting hospitals there. They are supporting cancer patients. They have the Center of Cancer Patients. So this is the only way, you know, to heal, is to keep helping, you know, as we can. I mean, as possible as we can.
Yeah, and you mentioned, I know in the documentary at one point, you mentioned how just everyone being so malnourished, especially a lot of the children, it was very difficult to even give them medications, because for one, if you're not eating enough food, you know, that's going to be the first thing you need to start doing before you can even really start taking medications and allow them to have the proper effect. How were people getting food into their houses? Like, what? Because obviously there's restrictions. People can't transport food into the country. So what was like the primary way of people getting food for their families?
Yeah, when the siege started, it was very hard time. It started in 2013. And when winter come, I can remember, we really had nothing to eat. It's, you know, somewhere in countryside of Damascus, so people plant many things, used to plant, I mean, but they start to eat everything we had. And then I remember very, very hard time for a few months in the winter. And I remember some people died because of hunger, and they were, you know, you can see everyone, very, very thin people, the children, all of them like were underweight. And that was very hard time. When summer come, people start to plant some, you know, the green plants. It wasn't, you know, enough. It didn't make them full, but it helps a little. And then after this, we make these tunnels to connect. It was a secret tunnels to connect the place with Damascus. But it was, you know, hard. Like, you know, a tunnel, you can just move some food, not a food for 500,000 people. So they tried to smuggle some food, and then the Syrian regime know about these tunnels and bombed it and destroyed it and tried to make others. And there were like sometimes from the checkpoints, which, you know, besieged the area, they send smuggle, I mean, with these leaders. I mean, you know, they call them the war leaders who try, you know, to make a trade at this time. So they try to sell a barley. It's a, you know what is barley? It's something, you know, it's not very good to eat. But we were dependent on this barley to eat for a few years. I remember this. That's why the children were like very underweight. They were malnourished. There were no, of course, no fruits, no vegetables. But we depend on what we can plant there, some green vegetables. And with the, for this barley, sometimes smuggle something from the tunnel. Sometimes we had nothing. But people tried to use everything we had. And I remember we had, for example, we had no sugar. We had no salt. And you know how bad our life was with no salt and no sugar? Very bad, I mean. And people start to use salt from different resources, use other things. And one night they use something. It's supposed to be sold, and a family bought this from someone, and they bought it on their food, and they ate it, and then they suffocated, and the three children died from this family. We found out after this it wasn't sodium chloride, it was ammonium chloride, and they ate it, and they just died, you know. And many times we bought things, and we didn't know what it is. I remember we just test these things. It's like sugar, but it's not real sugar. I don't know, actually. Maybe something like aspartame or something like this. And we ate this, and children ate this. It's unhealthy, you know, but we tried. I mean, when you are hungry, really hungry, you need something to eat. That's why we tried many, many things.
Yeah, absolutely. I also noticed that I feel like the community of doctors and medical professionals that you had in the cave, it looked like you all really formed a strong community with one another. And it seemed like it really helped for all of you to get through these difficult times. Can you talk a little bit about the role that the community of you and the other medical professionals in the cave, just kind of what role and impact that had for you?
Yes, we were like really a big family since we start working. I know everyone in the hospital. The staff were like 100 or more in the Cape Hospital. I know everyone. I know their families. I know what, I mean, they have, what their problems. I know everything. Their, you know, siblings, the people who have after. When someone of them, for example, lost one, you know, of their family's member in the bombing, we all, you know, be together to try, you know, to take them past this. It was, you know, very hard time. We cook together sometimes when we have, you know, some food. We try to cook together, and you can see this in the documentary. The nurse Samahar was cooking for us. You know, we try to have, you know, some happy moments, happy times. I mean, of this, I mean, you know, we are human beings, and life continues. It's years. It's not a day or a month. It's years. So we try to have these happy moments, try to support each other, to talk to each other. When we really feel, you know, everyone has this moment when you feel that you can't continue. I mean, you can't go on. I had these moments many times. So we started, you know, to talk with each other, to say this, to support each other. And that's really, you know, that really helped us to just to pass through this, to go through this, and, you know, to survive.
Yeah, I think community is such an important, plays such an important role in everyday life as well. But especially when you're in a very difficult time. It can be kind of the make or break for you. You know, it can really be something to lean on, and in times where maybe you're not as strong, people can lean on to you, or sorry, you can lean on to them, and vice versa. When others aren't strong, they can lean on to you. And as well, I saw that you played what seemed like a very large role in the lives of many of the children that came into the cave as well. I saw in the documentary, for example, there was a young girl that you were speaking with, and just trying to give her the best advice that you possibly could at that time, and really just being a role model and a parental figure to her. So I'm sure there is also a lot of that as well, right?
Well, yeah, and that, and when we have some time, I try just to speak with the children. You know, the hardest thing is seeing the fear in their eyes when I was working with the children, and it's really hard. And always when I look at their eyes and I see this fear, they didn't know what happened. They have nothing to do with war and with bombing, and they don't know why they have to be hungry, why they didn't have something to eat, because, they had this before and now there's no food. They don't understand. They understand nothing of what's happening. So I tried just, and that doesn't happen a lot because I didn't have time for everyone. I remember, for example, sometimes 100 child with, of course, their parents or someone came to my clinic a day. It's a lot. I can't see everyone and deal with everyone with my, limited experience. So yeah, when I have time, try just to talk to them, support them, try to bring them hope, tell them that they can survive, everything will change. It's just, some time and it will pass. You're going to forget about this. You're going to go to school. You will be happy. You will have your friends, have your favorite foods. And that helps children. They believe us, and especially they believe the doctor, for a child, the doctor is, someone. When I say something for them, they trust me. And yeah, I was happy to support them.
Yeah, they were absolutely lucky to have you, for sure. And it just makes me wonder how difficult of a time they're going to have in the future, trying to process these events that they've been through. And I'm sure there's going to be, a lot of work to do there as well. One thing I was wondering was there anything that didn't get captured in the documentary or even in your book as well, that you feel should have been highlighted more, or maybe just wasn't included at all?
Well, at the documentary, actually, at the beginning, I wasn't happy with the documentary because I thought it's 90 minutes. I mean, for everyone, it's not short, but I thought it's very short comparing with what we witnessed, what we see. I wanted, when I went out, I wanted the people to see everything happen, everything, every suffering for every human being, for every child. That was very hard to me. I mean, when I watched the documentary, I said, where's this child? Why? I mean, there's no blood in the documentary, no heart scene. They said they don't want to hurt people who are watching. But I said, but we saw this and this happened. The child was hurted, So yeah, that hurt for me. And that's why I decided to write the book, to tell the whole truth. It's impossible to tell everything, but I tried with this book to tell the many, many stories, many things happened. I think it can tell the people to give a good idea about what happened there, the truth, especially now the Syrian regime and Russia and everyone saying their, propaganda and talking their lies about what happened, and they called us terrorists. And I wanted to tell the truth. I wanted to tell the stories of the victims. And I'm happy I was able to tell this story through the book with my co-author, Rania. I'm thankful for her to write this story in this really great way. And yeah, I wish that everyone read this book to know about Syria. I wanted to write more and more about the suffering of the Syrian people now, especially in camps, in whole Syria, also in the Syrian regime area, in northwest, northeast, everywhere. It's, Syria now, different parts with different, people who control it, many camps in Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon. I tried to give an idea about the situation of these people and the refugees also in every country, about their suffering. But I wish people who read the book to, you know, research more and try to know more about these people, because I'm sure that you can help everyone who read the book. You can do something to help people who are suffering.
Yeah. Well, on that note, what are some things that people can be doing right now to support and help, you know, the Syrian refugees, but also just in general, Syria or refugees of other countries?
Thank you for this question. And this is really my goal of this book. I mean, know about Syria, read this book, and know about these people suffering, the children suffering. When you sit with your children, they are safe and warm. Just think a little about other children. Speak up for Syria. Tell everyone about these stories. With the politicians, with the parliament members, with everyone. We can make pressure on the politicians, especially, I mean, in the US, in Europe, and they can make a pressure on the Syrian regime, at least to release the detainees, the people who are being tortured every day for now, maybe for 13 years or more. And, you know, also before the revolution, many, many political detainees, they do nothing but talk a little about freedom, or they demand democracy for our country. So they are dying in the prison every day. You can donate also for the organizations who are supporting people inside or outside Syria, supporting refugees. You can donate for this organization. They support, try to support everything. And they need a lot, you know, of humanitarian aid, like medical, education. Everything is needed in Syria.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that as well. I'll be sure, you know, after this, if you would like to send over any links as well, websites where people can donate or learn more. Of course, we'll have that in the description. But before we continue on with that, I wanted to also ask, was writing this book, because you definitely go way more in depth. I wasn't able to read the entire thing, but I read definitely a lot of it, and you do go way more in depth. Was it therapeutic for you to write that? What did it help to get these thoughts out onto paper and to kind of go through them? Did you find it beneficial in any way, or was it just difficult the entire time?
Yeah, exactly. It helps me a lot because, you know, I always feel like I had a burden on my shoulder. It's a responsibility. I know about these children, and I said, many children who suffered or who died, no one see them but me. I mean, no one knows about them but me. And it's a responsibility. They shouldn't go in this way and just they were killed with their dreams, with their suffer, and no one know about them. And I felt I have to tell everyone their stories, everyone. I mean, because the criminals still, you know, the president still as a president now in Syria, with, you know, all the people around him who support him, and they must hold accountable for what they did. So we need justice for these people. So telling this story, writing this book, is, you know, helps me before having everyone that I tell these stories. You know, I will die. No, I will not live forever. But this story should stay. And everyone who read this story, I wish they try to get justice for these people.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's very impactful. Your book is very well written, covers some very, very intense stuff that I think is important for people to read and to hear about, because it really does put into perspective, you know, for example, for myself, it, you know, puts my life into perspective and just seeing how lucky I am to be where I am, and very fortunate, you know, and to really just give myself gratitude, or to find gratitude in being so lucky. And it really makes me want to definitely learn more and to help out as well. So I really appreciate you doing what you're doing. And you know, I hope you continue on, keep spreading this message, because like you said, you know, of course, we're all going to eventually die one day, but
These stories can absolutely live on and very well should. And I think there's some very valuable lessons in them. And I really applaud you for taking the time to write this book and get your message out there.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm really thankful because you helped tell this story. So thank you so much. And yeah, really, it's our responsibility, you know, to know about other people who suffer. If we are safe, I'm safe now with my children, you know. Everyone who is, you know, sitting in safe place, I wish you stay safe always. I wish there's no more wars around the world. But we have to think about each other as a human beings. This is the goal of the life.
Absolutely. Dr. Amani, here, as we start getting to the end of this episode here, I would like to take a moment first off with one last question, as well as, well, actually, maybe two more questions there. But first off, let's start with, what does the future of Syria look like? What do you think is going to come in the next 5 to 10 years? Do you see, you know, a possibility for change in the country, or does it seem like it might take longer than that?
Well, I decided to stay hopeful, you know, and this is a decision actually, because the situation is very bad and we can see help, you know, or maybe, but I decided to stay hopeful. We will fight. I mean, if we fight for something, I'm fighting for justice. I'm fighting to helping the people. So if we fight for something and we believe that it's not going to happen, so, you know, it's not, you can't fight. I mean, you can't do what you have to do in good way. So I decided to stay hopeful, and I wish for Syria, and I'm sure this will happen someday, justice, hold the criminals accountable. They will leave Syria to prisons, and we will back to our country, rebuild our country, and, you know, try to help each other, the Syrians, especially, you know, all the Syrians are really, they want to build their countries, so we can help each other and make our country great.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm staying hopeful as well. I think that's a good way to look at things, right? It doesn't help to be pessimistic about it. So I think keeping an optimistic outlook is a great idea. The last question here that I have for you, Dr. Amani, as someone who has experienced more than many people will ever experience in their lifetime, what would be three pieces of advice or wisdom that you would like to just, if you could leave that with everybody on the planet, what would those three pieces of advice or wisdom be?
Well, try to know more about other people, other stories, and believe that you can help. Don't underestimate yourself, your efforts. Do your part. I mean, in this life, every one of us have to do their part. And I'm doing my part. If everyone, you know, do, it's a responsibility. It's not something that we just volunteer. If I want to help these people or not. No, you have to help everyone. And someday you need help, you know. So just think about this. Think about other people and do something for them. Don't say, like, for example, I'm not talking about only Syria, about everywhere. Many places, you know, people are suffering. Many, many places in the world. So just think about these people. Don't say, no, Syria is far, other, you know, is far and we are okay here. No, we have to help each other. So this is my advice for everyone, especially for the young people who are, you know, the hope now, the young generation. And I'm really happy to see young people now are, you know, they care about these good issues. They care about everything, about the people who are suffering, the innocent people, about the earth, talking about the climate change. It's, you know, something promised.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, once again, just kind of coming back to that term of community, but rather looking at community as everyone on the planet, right? Like, we're a global community and, you know, we're all neighbors to one another, and extending a hand, like you said, can be so beneficial because you never know when you're going to need someone to help you as well. So yeah, having that compassion to help each other out, I think is extremely important.
Exactly. Yeah, this is what I mean.
Yeah, I love that, Dr. Amati. Well, I want to open the floor here for you as we wrap up this episode to just let people know where they can find you, where they can connect with you, where they can learn more. Of course, like I said, we'll go ahead and put all of this in the description of the show, but please go ahead and take this moment to share whatever you would like to share with the listeners here.
Well, I wish everyone read the book. It will give you a very good idea about the Syria situation, what happened in Syria. And it's, you know, the publisher is National Geographic. You can find it in the everywhere, I mean, in bookstores and online. And you can find me if you want to contact me on my social media. I mean, I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and X. So I'm available.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. I'm not sure if I've followed you on there yet, so I will be doing so for sure. And we will definitely keep in touch, Dr. Amati. Once again, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for all of the work that you've done and continue to do. And it was absolutely an honor to have you on this podcast. And yeah, I really appreciate you. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. The honor is all mine.
Well, thank you so much, everyone. Please go ahead and get in touch with Dr. Amati, find her on Instagram or any of the socials, and educate ourselves. Let's do our best to do that and contribute in whatever way that we can. Till then, we'll see you on the next episode, and thank you all very much.
This podcast is for educational purposes only. It is not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or other qualified medical professional. Evan Roberts is not a medical professional, and this podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. Statements and views expressed on this show are not medical advice. This podcast, including Evan Roberts and any guests on the show, disclaims responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained in this episode. If you think you have a medical problem, please consult a medical professional.